Flanagan's fourth and final part of its Summerfest series featuring Bob Babish and Scott Zeal. Our conversation with the guys ends with them discussing scouting the music scene here in Milwaukee, untold stories from booking some of the biggest acts in the world, some of their career highlights, and more. Enjoy the show.
So there isn't a local band that doesn't want to play Summerfest. What goes into selecting those bands?
I think that, like anything, we're watching, looking, and listening all year long, talking to the people who do the clubs.
So the Shank Halls, you're talking to the local.
Absolutely.
Sullivan and Calhoun.
Anybody who, you know, is involved with Cactus, Club Garibaldi, any of the, you know, the bars on the west side, they're doing country or, you know, straight up rock. We just basically, you're reading, you're talking to people, you know, it's fun, like from year to year, watching some band just pop on the scene out of nowhere and become somebody. So we're basically trying to pick the best acts that we can.
And a lot of times when you have a national, you know, a baby band national that has to travel and has expensive agents and managers and everything else, and there's somebody that nobody knows and has maybe one song, and they say, well, we have to have $5,000 to $7,000 to play it, and we go, why would we do that? But I've got how many bands in Milwaukee that don't have to travel, and I don't have to pay that much. I'll put four times as many people in front of the stage as you will, you know. And there are the McCurdy's of the world, and plenty of bands in Milwaukee that you want to do that will do a great job for you. And everybody knows it's going to have fun. You know, it's good to get back the bands that made it successfully here. Like, it's good to get the Femmes, it's good to get the Bodines, it's good to get all those guys back here playing. But there is such a group of people that come out of this town that are so good.
Well, and like Cheap Trick, that's more of a regional play, right. Same idea. But, I mean, this is another way that Summerfest strengthens its bonds with the local community.
Oh, no doubt.
How many local bands do you book a year here? Ish.
Oh, I mean, it's gone down a little bit because we're doing some more national headliners during the day. But yeah, but let's see. What do you got? 8 stages, 3 to 4 acts a day.
There's generally about between 700 and 800 acts that perform over the festival. So I mean, I would say the majority of the daytime is obviously opportunities for us to support the local music scene, which we love doing. We want bands out talking about their Summerfest gig and that it's a big thing for them. So they're our mouthpiece. I mean, they're at their work or their parties, and they're saying, hey, we're excited to play at Summerfest. You coming? Blah, 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 blah. And watching the bands grow, and then you know some of the younger bands that are out, you know, they're chasing after that, they want to do this for a living, they want to get a contract, they want to get a manager and agent. I mean, we've had some really great opportunities to put them in front of thousands of people. You know, when you have a big national band at 10 o'clock that may not be carrying a band with them, or that's at the last minute somebody pulls out and you can give them a choice slot. I mean, I know you gave, I remember Trapper Shep, you know, getting a phone call when Willie Nelson's Outlaw Tour was coming through and they needed somebody, or they heard about Trapper and how he fit perfectly musically into that. And
Pink's DJ.
Oh, yeah. So my buddy Tim Zick. Tim goes by the name of Kid Cut Up, and it was actually that, remember that show that we were talking about, Wiz Khalifa? So we hired, what we've learned with the hip hop shows is that it's important that in between sets, the kids just want to be entertained the whole time. So there's sometimes inconsistencies of, you know, a hip hop artist might play 30 minutes or 40 minutes. It's not like a rock band that's playing 90 minutes. So we hired Tim Zick, Kid Cut Up, and this Jordan, who eventually became the program director of Radio Milwaukee.
So these are two local performers.
Two local performers to basically play in between leading up to Wiz Khalifa. And they put on one of the best. They just knew exactly what those kids wanted to hear. And so put together the perfect selection, got the crowd all hyped up. It was just so much great energy. So I fell in love with, we fell in love with Kid Cut Up. And whenever we could, you know, get him a good slot opening up for somebody, we did. And Bob calls up one day and Pink is performing in the amp. And they basically say, well, we're not really bringing anybody on tour with us, so we'd like to, could you recommend a local DJ? And so we did. Tim was at the top of our list, but we had to put a couple others on it. They reviewed his stuff and they hired him. And after the show went so well and he did his homework and the crowd loved it, that they basically, Pink has taken him on tour in the United States, worldwide.
Wow. Yeah, he's been with her for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
So if I'm a local band and I'm listening to this, what's the best way to get considered by Summerfest? Is it just be out playing the local?
It's go out, play the local places, and make sure that those people that are at those local places know you. And eventually one of us will be talking to somebody and they'll mention a band and
sure.
give a shot at that.
When considering local bands, what's the biggest mistake they make?
I don't know. Just living by the rules when they finally play here. You know, don't do anything dumb like carry a Budweiser can onto the Miller stage or say something stupid from the stage or not get here on time or not do a long enough show or not be arrogant. Just play along with us and we tell you what we need you to do. Right. We tell you what gear you can bring and can't bring. We tell you not, you know, who you're going to bring along, road guys, don't bring girlfriends backstage, all that kind of stuff. And,
sure.
and do a good job. And if you do a good job and the people come and listen to you, yeah, you'll get hired back here again.
And I think there's the polite persistence in terms of trying to get a gig. I think people, some artists can be too aggressive if they, you know, where it's just they're banging down the door and won't leave you alone kind of thing. And just communicating in a way where it's like, top of mind, here's what we're doing, here's kind of the story that we're building. But I think in a lot of ways, the if you're doing something good in the community, we're going to hear about you.
Yeah, and I have no problem with persistence. I mean, as long as you're not obnoxious to us. But I have no problem with somebody calling every week, every other week or 2-3 weeks and saying, do you get a chance to listen to us? Do you know anybody who's heard us? Blah, 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 blah. Hey, that works for me, you know.
I don't mind that either. There have been some acts that are like, it's almost like they get so worked up that they're, why am I not getting a gig?
They get mad if they don't get a gig. Right. That does not work for me.
Yeah, so it's kind of like that. But if you're out making great music and putting on a great live show, we're going to find you. We're going to hear about you. It'll happen.
So over the past week, we heard of the untimely passing of Taylor Hawkins. And I remember last summer, that was like the kind of re-engaging live music here, right?
There's the hat. There's a souvenir hat today.
They played, there you go. They played a show here. And I think they played back in 2012.
Oh, they played here a number of times through the years.
So I think anybody who is into music, and especially rock music, is feeling that over the last week or so. Any memories of him? Did you ever get a chance to meet him or speak with him?
I didn't meet Taylor, but I mean I've met Dave because he's usually he's the guy you talk to whenever something's going on. He's a good guy actually, but Taylor Hawkins, I mean I've been singing his praises for years because that he drives that band. I mean Dave was a drummer that drove Nirvana. Right, and then when he got done with Nirvana and he put this new band together, he needed somebody that was a kindred spirit that could play like he would play. Well, he came up with a guy that was better, that could he take any song that Dave had and drive it and drive that whole band at it. And my favorite story is not the last time he was here, but the time before that, it was, 104 degrees in the building. It was like the hottest day we'd had in a long time. And those guys did 2 hours plus of typical, that kind, you know, that Foo Fighters banging style.
The real athletic.
And he'd be laying across the drums between songs, and a roadie would come on and just pour cold water on his head, and he'd shake his head, and off he'd go again. And when he passed away the other day, we were having this conversation in the office. I said, you know, I'm going to sit here and try to come up with maybe two, maybe three drummers that could join that band. And then Vic will say, oh, no, there's plenty of guys. I said, no, there's not. No, there's not. There's only a handful of people out there that can do, to play like he did for the amount of time that he would play on stage and smile the whole time and have this incredible love for what he was doing. That was a sad one. That one hurt. Yeah.
Scott, any insight on him, or did you ever cross paths?
There's a local tie-in with the Foos because Josh Adams, who right. has a company called Mindpool Productions, does video. He connected with the Foo Fighters a long time ago and does live video for them. So when they would come to town, I think the only time that I was kind of like in the room, and it was when they were here for the Harley event, and then Taylor was doing his...
Chevy Metal.
So that's like his cover band of playing like
side project
70s and 80s stuff. So we knew, we hoped, like in the back of our head, like, okay, book Chevy Metal and it's a Harley event, and then maybe Dave will come out too. And of course he did, and you know, there was like,
didn't sing a song.
It was just fun for the people who were there because they, you know, they knew the connection of the Foos, but then Dave shows up and it's like, it's crazy. There was just like, my experience behind the stage in the dressing room for a couple of minutes was just like, these guys, they're buddies, they love what they're doing, this isn't a job, this is their life, you know. He was very you know, cordial, and like, how many times are you, you know, someone's like, hey, meet so and so, blah blah blah. But I agree with Bob, I don't know, like, I mean, there are somebody's out there,
yeah,
but it's somebody that hasn't been discovered yet, or somebody that's playing in a band. I mean, there's nobody that does what he does the way he does it. So it's a huge, you know.
And there's a band that is booked solid through the summer, and then the next question is, what does Dave do? How does Dave find, he may find that right person. First of all, he's got to get through the grieving part, and it's going to be challenging for him because they're the best friends, right? But now you've got to find a person that you feel can live up to the legacy of what he created musically. And how long does it take to integrate that into the band and make it sound like it used to sound? Mm-hmm. Or do you just retool everything and just start over, take the band down, find a new name, keep a bunch of same guys that want to do it, and start over? I don't know. It's a difficult question because there's a lot of money on the table.
So to that point, I read in Roger Daltrey's autobiography, he talked about when John Entwistle passed away the night before their tour at the Hard Rock. Remember that story? And what he talked about is, you know, we decided to go on. We moved three dates, and we put them at the back of the tour that were at the front of the tour, and we got Pino Palladino in, and the rest is history. But the point I remember, and I love your reaction to this, is he said, what people don't realize is that to fund a tour, you front that money. You're paying insurance, you're paying to create the set, the stage and everything. And you spend most of your tour paying all that off. You have 100 people on payroll, and they have all got mortgages to pay, and there's financial realities of this. And you don't make the money until the back end of the tour. You don't make, so you have to pay off, you're paying off this debt at the front end of the tour. And so he said, you know, we took some heat when we kept going. People said, well, how can you possibly keep going? But he's like, it's not that easy. How does that ring to you? Does that make sense?
I think partially it does. And maybe at that time they weren't making the kind of money that they make now on the road. I mean, they've made a lot of money the last few years. It's a hard, I mean, maybe not as much because of COVID there, but since COVID was kind of over, they've been playing a lot. And these dates may get rescheduled to another time, but I just don't know artistically how long it's going to take. You know, and that's until he can turn around and look and be happy with what he's hearing. I mean, he's got his core guys that are still, you know, Pat Shamir and all those guys are all still there, but the band was driven by this one. I mean, this one guy just took him by the neck and just shook him down the street when they played like they played, you know. So I don't know, it'll be interesting to see how it all works out.
I mean, I think to me, my impression, I mean, day when the pandemic hit and things started getting better and shows could start being booked, the Foo Fighters wanted to be, they were the first band back in Madison Square Garden, right? They wanted, I mean, that's, it just, to me, that's
music healing, right?
Yeah, and then who Dave is. It's like, it's bringing people together and we're fighting for this. And so my impression now is like I wouldn't be surprised if he's out, like he's gonna, if he might have to, you know, interview 100 drummers until he finds somebody that he's not gonna I think he, to me, like he's like, this is, I gotta carry this on, you know, I gotta do this because it's in my blood, because of the legacy, Taylor's legacy, you know, and I can't stop, you know. I could be wrong, but that's just the way, you know, like fighting adversity.
Then the question is how long before that you get to that?
Right.
Yeah, you're
is
right.
Is it 6 months?
That,
is
that
it,
ingredient, yeah.
Yeah, is it 6 months? Is it 6 weeks? Because now you got to rehearse everything.
Absolutely. It's not easy. Absolutely. I mean, well, and there aren't they scheduled for...
There must be a Foo Fighters cover band, so.
In South Korea?
Yeah.
Just like the guy from Journey or whatever.
Pianetta?
I don't know.
To Journey's credit, though, they made him an equal partner.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll tell you, he's a ringer.
Yeah.
He sounds.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
He sounds. Well, and you know, speaking of ringer, what you were talking about with the kind of vibe in the Foo Fighters, and I sense this. I was at the McCartney show here. Of the musicians he surrounded himself with, they all get it. They all get how lucky they are. You get the sense that they're not taking it for granted, that they realize, like these kids who are backing McCartney, you can tell that they're like, yeah, we won the lottery.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you definitely got that from the Foo Fighters too. You definitely get that from Dave Grohl and those guys, that they don't take it for granted.
Right.
Just a few other questions here, and this just has to do with your careers. Like thinking back on your careers, you know, any highlights, Bob, start with you. Any highlights from your career that are especially poignant or meaningful to you?
Oh, there's a lot, probably.
Other than this podcast.
Yeah, of course. It goes without saying. I think the first time that we had Pearl Jam and they canceled because of Ticketmaster.
Was this the place?
Yeah, well, we had two dates scheduled and they were out for, I think, 10 or 12 dates. And we, were, of course, were sold out. And then they were going to make a statement about, it was Ticketron at that time, about fees being too high. So they canceled all their dates. And Patrice Harris was here at the time, and marketing person. And we went on this begging campaign for like 2-3 straight days, convincing them that we had the lowest fees of anybody in the country, because we did at the time. I mean, we were like down to nothing. You got to play these dates, and they're sold out. It's for the people, and we're a people's festival. And finally, they came back and said, okay, we'll do those two dates. And those were the only two dates they did. And when the lights went down and that crowd started screaming, we just said, oh, man, wow, that's impressive that we get a chance to
dodge that,
to
like
pull that off.
Yeah.
We've dodged some things through the years. We've had bands. One year, I can't remember all of them, but I remember thinking about this when it was over, how lucky we were. But we had three different amphitheater shows that this was their last date for different reasons. One, because the lead guitar player's father died that day and they didn't want to tell him until the show was over. Then after they told him after the show was over and the rest of the tour canceled. A couple days later, somebody got sick the night before they were here and struggled through the show here. And then I forget what they had, but they had to cancel the rest of the dates after that. And it was one other person, I can't remember
what
it was.
Who were those bands?
I probably shouldn't say it, but I probably can't. No, I won't say it. Fair I won't. Yeah, but in, I can't think of the third one. But it was the exact same thing. Something traumatic happened, and they had to cancel the dates after that. And after the whole festival sits down, because you're just going. Because in those days you didn't have any days off in between, right? You just ran straight days. And then we all sat down, and I thought, God, we're this close to losing three shows.
And the concert goer has no idea how much you are running around, putting out fires, sticking your fingers in the dam, trying to keep everything together, despite the fact that you've planned it all and the relationships are sound. Those random things, like somebody has a death in the family, that's completely uncontrollable. Scott, what about you, looking back, like memories?
There's so many great ones. I think the feeling of like, wow, I've really kind of done well enough when Bob let me book my first amphitheater show, which was Neil Young. And it was with an agent that he had kind
of... mine first was Neil Diamond. No, just kidding.
Neil Diamond. Neil's. No, there was an agent that's kind of crazy, and Bob, after a while, just kind of gave up dealing with her. And he said, there you go, if you can... So patient over time, built a relationship with her, booked some of her younger bands on the grounds. And then one year, she calls up and she's like, well, I've got Neil Young routed out to Red Rocks. You want to do a show? And I was like, yeah. And then I hung up the phone. I was like, I don't really know how to do this. Well, I think I do. And then, it's like, oh, check the prices. And she's, okay, expect all the stuff. And then I knew. And, just being there through the whole process and then, making sure that this is literally the first date of the tour. So they were hypersensitive, and the manager was here, and the agent was here. And the sense of... just fulfillment of being like, wow, it's like I've gone from being a kid that's doing contracts in the production office to somebody who's like Bob actually would trust to do a show in the amphitheater.
Were you sweating it? Were you nervous?
Honestly, I don't know that the...
Just fear.
You don't because really...
It's kind of like when a pilot solos for the first time.
Right. You don't really have time to... It's just like, okay, this is on. Let's go,
Which is better.
What do I do?
Once the day starts,
Right. And the thing that's, Bob is always, it's like, I feel comfortable I don't understand how this works. Tell me, I don't want to screw this up. No, there's no dumb question. It's like, so that was a really, really cool thing.
So, final question. Bob, favorite thing working with Scott?
I think that he, how would I put this? I don't delve into as carefully as he does a lot of the situations. He gets in there and analyzes better than I do. Sometimes I'm from the hip,
Got it.
I'm a little old school that way, where I say, well, this is gonna work. Let's just do it. Let's go there. And then he'll come back in here and he'll put a level-headed reason why we shouldn't do it. Or he'll put a level-headed reason why we should do it. Or he'll say, okay, I'll do it, but you're crazy. Or, but yeah. So we have a good yin-yang. And it's been that way for a long time. We listen to each other.
And that's apparent in this conversation, the back and forth. And this is the kind of thing, it's almost like a professional working telepathy that you kind of cultivate over time, that you develop over time. So same question to you, Scott. Favorite thing after all these years working with Bob?
Just to take off on what he talks about, it's like, if I'm like a little bit more methodical, it's like, get on the back of the Harley Davidson with Bob, we're going for a ride, what's the next adventure, where are we going, who are we going to meet, who are we going to book, that's we have to always get better, so we have to find somebody that we haven't gotten before, or how do we strategize things, Bob's right, it's that yin and yang of back and forth on things honestly, it's like you get tired after a while because it's like a long booking season, but the job never really gets old. There are nights, there are days where I'm like, no, I gotta, no, the lineups aren't good enough. We gotta do this. It's gotta be better, because you put that pressure on yourself. But it's like when the day is done and you finish the season, you're like, I'm getting paid to do this? Are you kidding me? Like, to sit here and like pick right. bands and watch people come and have a great time and like give them something that's really special. So it's like you never take it for granted. It's like
I remember sitting in two times that my wife has heard me really yelling on the phone. But I was having this incredible battle with an agent. I forget what it was about, but the language was hot and heavy and screaming at each other and kicking chairs and yelling. God, if I hang up the phone on a person and she's looking at me, I look at her and go, God, I love this business.
And I think that's a great place to close. Listeners, thank you for joining us today. You just heard from two men who are just at the top of their game, just masters at what they do. Bob Babish, who's the Vice President of Entertainment for Summerfest, and Scott Zeal, who's the Director of Entertainment for Summerfest. Gentlemen, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
And thank you for all that you've done for our community and all the lives that you've affected through all of these great acts that have come through and all the work you've done behind the scenes. An extra special thank to Griffin, my colleague, who's been sitting across from me, who's
thank you,
producing
Griffin.
The
thank
show. You. He's a rock star in his own right. Thank you for producing the show today, and thank you again, gentlemen.
Thanks for listening to our Summerfest series. We hope you subscribe to stay up to date on future episodes, and to learn more about Brannigan, visit us at BranniganInc.com.